to try and get to the bottom of this internal infighting and this eating of their own, we've brought on an author and journalist. He's written many, many articles about the Trump White House, and his book is called Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. The author, Joshua Green. Is the Trump Revolution eating its own?
Yeah, I think that always happens around Donald Trump. The people go into business with him expecting great things and wind up disappointed by the transaction. And so a lot of the people who helped Trump get elected, including Steve Bannon, who's one of the characters in my book, I think expected a different kind of, you know, a less hawkish president, a less belligerent president when it came to foreign enemies like North Korea. And instead, you know, Trump is off in his golf club, holed up, watching Fox News and making wild threats against an unstable leader in North Korea. That's the opposite of the disposition toward the rest of the world that Trump really campaigned on.
Yeah, I thought, and in fact, it doesn't Steve Bannon, at least from what I've read in the articles, is sort of not, he has other agenda items that he wants to deal with first and not going to war against North Korea or China, at least at this time. How is it that the warmonger, and that's his own wife who's called him that, is in now the dove?
Well, because Bannon's idea of America first nationalism that Trump kind of picked up and used as a campaign theme, although it's not clear to me he ever believed in a lot of it, you know, had several tenets. And, you know, we know a lot of the more controversial ones, deporting undocumented immigrants and shutting down the border. And you have Trump wanting to limit even legal immigration and trying to bring back manufacturing jobs and that whole kit and caboodle. Part of that was Bannon's belief that a neoconservative foreign policy that seeks to project American strength and impose democracy by force, not just in the Middle East but in other places, was fundamentally the wrong direction. So Bannon is much more of an isolationist or somebody who at least wants to limit America's projection of power abroad. And that is an idea that Trump embraced, and I think led to some of his popularity as a candidate. But as with so many other Trump promises on the campaign trail, once he's gotten into office, he has surrounded himself with different sorts of people. And so, you know, on the other side of that ledger, you have H.R. McMaster as national security director. And right now, there is an open war going on in Trump's administration by between, you know, the nationalist isolationists led by Bannon and McMaster and a lot of the military generals who not only want to take an aggressive stance toward North Korea, but want to send more troops to Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the important battles going on in the White House right now, and it's one that has bubbled up to the surface given McMaster's desire to take control of American foreign policy and Bannon's unwillingness to let go of his role in it.
I see. Tell us, how did you get to get interested in writing a book about Steve Bannon? How did you get to know him and begin the process of writing this book, Devil's Bargain?
Well, weirdly enough, I met Bannon back in 2011, and he was the guy who reached out to me. I'd never heard of him, but I had just come back. I was writing for The Atlantic at the time and just come back and did a long article on Sarah Palin. And Bannon at the time had maneuvered himself into Palin's inner circle and occupied a role, you know, not unlike the one that he wound up playing for Donald Trump. And at the time, everybody thought that Palin was going to be running for president in 2012. And Bannon back then was a conservative filmmaker who was shooting a documentary about her. So he invited me over to a screening room to see his documentary, which I didn't think was very good. But Bannon himself was an interesting guy who had a very distinct kind of populist nationalist politics that you just didn't see represented in Washington, where I live. And he was a smart and slightly scary but colorful character. And as a magazine writer, that's the kind of guy I like to hang around with instead of your typical Republican or Democratic congressman. So I got to know him over the years, spent a lot of time interviewing him, and profiled him in 2015. And then when he wound up in charge of the Trump campaign, you know, he knew me, he trusted me, and so I had a lot of access and was able to write this book based on, you know, hundreds of hours of interviews with him as well as some interviews with Donald Trump.
I see. And what was your takeaway as far as what is it about this populism? How would you maybe sum it up in one iconic belief about how the world should be that sort of shocked you or amazed you about Mr. Bannon?
Well, I think you boil it down to, you know, America first nationalism, that America has to put its own interests first. And under that rhetorical umbrella, you can show a lot of things, from stop sending troops and money abroad to let's shut our borders and push out, you know, immigrants who are here or who want to come here, to, you know, let's focus on white working class manufacturing people who've been laid off and are looking for jobs. The whole ethos of the Trump campaign, a lot of that was driven by Bannon, who, let's remember, you know, began as a filmmaker and studied the Nazi propaganda filmmakers of the 1940s, like Leni Riefenstahl.
Isn't that what they call him?
Oh, yeah. No, it wasn't Drudge. It was Andrew Breivik. So in my book, you know, actually, I the first trip I took with Bannon, oddly enough, was to Pella, Iowa, where he was going out with Palin and her husband and Andrew Breitbart and the whole menagerie of people surrounding Palin then to debut his film on Palin, which we in the press corps thought was her winking way of signaling that she was going to run for president in 2012, because, of course, Iowa, that's where you go. That's the first caucus state. And after the movie screening, I was hanging around with Andrew Breitbart, the late conservative provocateur, who said, you know, Bannon is such a powerful guy. He's the Leni Riefenstahl of the Tea Party movement. And I laughed, thinking it was an off-color joke. And Breitbart said, no, I'm absolutely serious. He is. And that is a label that Bannon himself has embraced. And he's told me, and he did for the book, that he studies these filmmakers. He thinks they have power to shape mass opinion, and that's exactly what he was doing in the Trump campaign with Donald Trump through this idea of America first nationalism.
Well, do Trump supporters have a lower sense of art, and when it comes to film, because Leni Riefenstahl, I've seen her films and they were scarily good, and I've tried to watch his films and they seem to be pretty much like, you know, the same stuff, you know, the outside occupy really foreign, at least finance, outside agitators. They don't have communism anymore, so they make up George Soros, who's, of course, Jewish. I mean, but at the same time, Breitbart and his magazine, how do they fit the Nazi anti-Semitism thing angle with the fact that that Breitbart started out as a pro-Israel sort of magazine or news?
Well, Bannon as Breitbart to reject the label that they're anti-Semitic and point out that not only was Andrew Breitbart Jewish, he died in 2012. Larry Soloff, the CEO, is Jewish. They're big Israel hawks. That's the one place where Bannon seems to be more hawkish on foreign policy. They reject that label, and it's a bit of a contradiction, because of course, if you look at what they publish, a lot of the people and the readers it attracts are people who are, alt-right types who espouse anti-Semitic themes and tweet out Pepe the Frog imagery and white nationalism, that whole nine yards. So I think Bannon is willing to make common cause with a lot of those people, and is very, very interested, I mean, to a striking degree, not only in Nazi and fascist filmmakers, but also the intellectuals. And part of what I talk about in Devil's Bargain is Bannon's whole intellectual underpinning for his nationalist philosophy, which draws on a lot of the Nazi and fascist thinkers in the 1930s and 40s, who Bannon claims he's interested in simply because those are the big nationalist thinkers, and that's when they were most powerful. But, of course, if you are some white nationalist or anti-Semite and you're looking for a political movement, and you know that the chief ideologist, Steve Bannon, you know, is reading and talking about your favorite Nazi philosopher as well, you know, you're probably going to be attracted to that candidate instead of a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio.
Mm-hmm. Now, standing behind behind Breitbart, behind Bannon, behind these folks was this family, the Robert Mercer and the Mercer family. And in many ways, would you say that they are financing and have financed Bannon to become as powerful as he has?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I have a whole chapter on the wild tale of the Mercer family in Devil's Bargain. And I call them the merchant bankers for Steve Bannon, in a sense for Donald Trump, too, because they funded so many of these interlocking conservative groups that nobody really knew about or paid attention to, that over the last few years had worked in concert. It was literally a conspiracy to besmirch and tear down Hillary Clinton. And so these were the groups that were responsible for the Clinton cash book. I talk about this in my book.
Right.
That what was a years-long research effort funded by the Mercers.
Yeah. And what is it true, though, I've heard many people to this day tell me, oh, you should read Clinton Cash. I mean, a lot of people who you would be surprised, they didn't seem like very conservative people, were motivated by that book.
Well, and here's why. And this was Bannon's most important insight, I think, into Clinton. You know, Bannon was around, although not involved in politics, in the late 1990s, and had what I thought was a very astute analysis of why conservatives failed to stop Bill Clinton in the 1990s. And Bannon said that was because they became so whipped up in their own spin and wild rumors that they didn't recognize that they weren't persuading anybody in the mainstream, in the media. And so they wound up talking to themselves in a bubble. And so Bannon's way of correcting that error with Hillary Clinton was to focus on facts and documentable relationships that he could publish. And these were aimed not at convincing conservatives, who, of course, were going to be anti-Clinton anyway, but of convincing investigative reporters at mainstream newspapers and magazines like, the New York Times and the Washington Post. And so funded with Mercer hedge fund money, they set up an institute down in Florida called the Government Accountability Institute. It's a nonprofit. It's all legal, and it's devoted to studying cronyism in politics. Well, they just happened to focus all of their effort and attention for about 2 years on documenting all of Clinton's financial ties through the Clinton Foundation to all sorts of questionable foreign autocrats and businessmen who had some pretty clearly shady motives. They put this all in a book, and they handed it off to investigative reporters at the New York Times who looked at it, who checked out the claims, who found out that a lot of them were valid, and who wrote about it and disseminated this negative information about Hillary Clinton that had the effect of disillusioning people who otherwise would have been her voters. And so that's one reason why I say in Devil's Bargain that Bannon really is responsible for getting Donald Trump elected, because he softened up and tore apart the woman who wound up challenging him in the presidential race.
I see. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship with Michael Flynn. General Flynn came on board and then had to very short, another one of the first in this pattern now of shortly after coming aboard being replaced because of ties. It turns out it seems to be the same story: ties with Russia, ties with oligarchs, ties with organized crime, over and over again. And were they friends? Are they close together? They work together. I know they seem to be united over this idea that of a Ground Zero mosque and of the fact that that there's some sort of almost like clash of cultures where Islam is attempting to take over and subvert Christian America, Judeo-Christian America.
I don't think that Bannon and Flynn actually knew each other for that long. Flynn entered the Trump orbit relatively late, but the reason he rose to such prominence is, A, he was a general, and Trump just worships generals, as we all know, and B, he was such an ardent Trump supporter right out of the gate that it won over Trump, because what does Trump really want? He wants people around him who worship him, who defer to him, and if one of those people happens to be a general, so much the better. So he came into Trump's orbit pretty late, but I think he and Bannon did share a lot of views about the perceived threat of Islam to the United States, but really to the entire Western world.
Right.
And one line of my research when I went looking for the intellectual and religious foundations underpinning Bannon's nationalism was to understand why he is so virulently Islamophobic. And the answer is that he had this right-wing Catholic upbringing. Like Donald Trump, he went to a military high school, but Bannon's was a Benedictine Catholic right-wing military high school that essentially taught the students that the entire Western world for thousands of years has been under constant threat of assault from foreign invaders and from Islam. So one of Bannon's classmates told me, we were taught that Christendom was saved from being overrun by the Moors in the 1500s by Ferdinand and Isabella in Spain, the Catholic monarchs. And so Bannon has a mindset that you always have to be on guard for this sort of thing. Well, Flynn, for whatever reason, has a kind of a similarly paranoid disposition toward Islam, toward the modern world. And I think the fact that they both viewed this threat the same way helped them to become fast friends during the Trump campaign.
I see. And I try to get behind motivations, why people feel it's so important to try and bring back. So we're not talking about make American great again. We're talking about make Western civilization great again. Let's go back to the days of the Crusades.
This is going to sound bizarre to your listeners, but it's true. I interviewed Bannon about the foundations of his beliefs, and what he told me sounds like a Dan Brown. I mean, it sounds like something out of the Da Vinci Code.
Somehow I'm not surprised.
But it's just absolutely bizarre. So he said, the reason he went back to these Nazi and fascist philosophers in the 40s, but he told me what I found was that they came from a common taproot, that there was a guy born in late 19th century France named René Guénon, who practiced occultism and was a Freemason and eventually converted to Sufi Islam, who is the founder of a belief system called primordial traditionalism that holds that every ancient religion, whether it's the Hindu Vedanta or paganism or ancient Christianity, has a common root, that the ultimate spiritual truths were revealed to mankind in the earliest ages of the world, but that we in the modern world have lost our connection to God because, beginning in the Enlightenment and the rise of the modern nation state, we've turned away from religion toward the state. And so Bannon's whole project, as Guignon's was to roll back the nation state system and return to a time of spiritual purity that Bannon and Guignon both located as being before the Enlightenment. So when people in the campaign said that Donald Trump wants to take us back to a pre-civil rights era, they were off by about 500 years. Bannon wants to go all the way back to the 1400s. And so this is the belief system underpinning a lot of what he's thinking about and doing.
The Medicis were big then. I think his reading of history is a little off, because he would find that those times were full of people eating their own back then as well. It's more complex than Mr. Bannon realizes, and folks who have these kind of beliefs sometimes realize. Let's talk about, in the next few minutes we have, his truth and honesty, and let's come back to North Korea. What's going to happen? What do you predict is going to happen, if anybody can predict, in this internal fight between factions that have such different opinions of what to do about North Korea? How is that going to play out? We already had a horrific, the world is frightened. My phone's been ringing off the hook. I'm sure everybody in this country right now and around the world is a little bit worried, no matter what they say and how much Mr. Tillerson and others say everything's okay. To talk like that with this country is North Korea, and with all the weapons involved, is talking tantamount to war, it seems, in most people's minds.
I've learned long ago that you can't predict what Donald Trump is going to do, but I think there are two possible scenarios. Number one, he's got General John Kelly has come in, a four-star Marine Corps general, to run his staff and to try and impose some kind of order and discipline. If you look at the chain of command that someone like Kelly would subscribe to, it's pretty clear that foreign policy and the National Security Council are the purview of H.R. McMaster, Trump's national security director. And so if Bannon and his allies are continuing to wage this war inside and outside the White House through the media, Kelly could very well crack down and convince Trump to push out Bannon. So that's one possibility. The other possibility, which seems a little bit more likely to me, is that Trump just isn't bothered by this chaos and fighting. I mean, he seems to enjoy having his advisors fight for his favor in the same way that contestants on The Apprentice, stabbed each other in the back to try and appeal to him on his TV show. That just seems to be Trump's comfort zone. And if that is in fact how Trump thinks about this, then I don't see any reason why necessarily the debate over North Korea would be resolved one way or the other. Trump claimed to be a nationalist in the campaign, but once we got to this past spring and things weren't working out, he said, "Well, I'm a nationalist and a globalist." It wouldn't surprise me at all if Trump says, "Well, I'm a dove, I'm a pacifist, I'm an isolationist, which he seemed to indicate during the campaign. But then he fills his staff with hawkish military generals, so maybe he's a hawk too. So it doesn't seem to me that Trump sees any distinction between being, you know, a hawk or a dove on North Korea. And if he doesn't, I don't think there's any reason why he's going to see a need to settle the debate between the two camps in his White House, the Bannon camp and the McMaster's camp.
He's just going to let it go on and on. But what is that going to mean as far as, and I don't know if we can even answer the question in the minutes we have, you know, what does this mean for Korea and the nuclear weapons and the future of the world? I mean, what does this actually mean for us? Like, in a sense,
I couldn't possibly hope.
Who cares about their internal fighting? What does this mean as far as all
these
nuclear?
Here's the thing. The more people push Trump to kind of back off a statement, the more he doubles down on it. And, you know, we've seen this already just in the last 24 hours. A lot of his staffers come out and try and clean up the damage. Oh, this wasn't really a threat. And then Trump comes out in his press conference and says, oh, no, it was. And maybe I'm going to threaten even harder. So I don't have any idea where it's going to wind up. But the idea that Trump is going to, you know, walk back his claims and you know, chasing himself for going too far in North Korea, I think is a very unlikely scenario.
Do you think he's playing the old Nixonian game of trying to seem so crazy that they don't know what they'll do next and maybe they'll
He could be. But you know, the other possibility is that he really is crazy and doesn't have a clear grip on foreign policy and the consequences of what he's saying. So
and Nixon did those things when they were losing the Vietnam War. That was like almost a desperate act. It didn't really work. You know, Nixon delayed things for a year or two, but in the end it all came crashing down anyway. So if he's playing the Nixonian card, it's not good either. It means that he doesn't have anything else to do, in my opinion.
Yeah, I strongly suspect that what's going on here is that he's watching Fox News and reacting to the stuff he sees in real time, hoping to seem tough and have an effect on what he sees on his television. Probably not the most sophisticated or responsible way to conduct foreign policy.
Right. Do you think, last question, do you think he's going to be impeached? Do you think he's going to finish his term, or are they going to throw him out?
I don't think he's going to be impeached because, you know, by and large, Republican base voters, Trump voters, still support him. You know, maybe in a couple of years, if something comes out or if he doesn't deliver for them, that support will erode. But to me, it seems almost like a cultural statement that, you know, we are with Trump just because of the people he makes angry and pisses off. That's certainly not going to change over the next 3.5 years. And so I suspect that his intense support among this narrow but consequential group of people is going to frighten off Republican legislators from doing away with him and impeaching him.
Wow, I'm glad Steve Bannon was in the Navy because it seems like batting down the hatches, there's a storm ahead. Joshua Green, tell us about your book and how people can get more information.
You can just go to, you know, Amazon. You can go to your local independent bookstore. You can go to Powell's. Just look for Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. It is the product of my 6 years intimately following and talking to Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, and is my best effort at explaining this pivotal relationship between these two guys who seem to have the fate of the free world in their hands.
I see. Very, very frightening. Thank you very
much.
Not to
put too light a touch on it. Yeah. Thanks so much, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for joining us, Joshua Green. Appreciate that. Well, that has been a powerful edition of Trump Watch. I have to thank Joshua Green for coming up. I think it leaves us a lot to think about, just who's in charge of our country. And it makes me more and more think that those folks who say we got to be out in the streets protesting every day might be onto something, because we cannot depend on impeachment or any sort of other through the system indictments or anything like that. As much as I love Stephen Colbert, I don't think it's going to go in that direction. I think that we have to get out in the streets and protest, protest, protest. I hear this protest planned for November. I hope before that as well. I'll be there, and I hope to see you all there in the streets, because we definitely have to keep an eye on these guys. All right, I'm Paul DiRienzo, PDRienzo, PDERIENZO at Twitter, and you can follow us on iTunes and SoundCloud. So I'll see you next week.